Nice to be back here. Always enjoy coming to London. When I say I go to London, people ask me, you go to London? England? This weekend? I say, no, not that far. Hope you had a good feast, all of you. We certainly did in France. There was a theme that was offered by Mr. Franks, and I hope you remembered it, and I hope you applied it during the feast as well. He said, to start with, let no one steal your joy. And I thought that was really a good theme, and it's a good theme for the Sabbath too. You know, I mean, if there's problems in this world, we know this world is going to get worse and worse and worse. But we are closer to God. We need to be closer to God. So we got to make sure that every Sabbath, nobody steals away our joy. And he mentioned in one of his last letters, too, he said, you know, even during the feast, there's things that go wrong. Well, you know the details of something that went wrong with the last day in St. Augustine, and those things happen. And I couldn't help but to think, well, you know, it's true. You know, nothing is perfect at the feast. There's always little things that, you know, don't work very well. Actually, the first day I arrived, I barely got there. I got two gentlemen who just got on my back and started complaining about stuff. And I thought, well, you know, let me breathe. I'm barely here. I barely arrived, and you're already complaining about something. And they spent quite a bit of time, and that was very discouraging to me. Then I thought about it. I said, you know what? Nobody is going to steal away my joy. I'm just going to have a good feast. So do the same thing today. Please do. This is what we're here for. If there's problems in this world, well, we knew about it. We've been warned for years, so we shouldn't be surprised. And by the same time, we've got to keep our minds on God. Before I get started, that were just preambles here, I always like to have a little bit of humor before I get started. This is a serious world. There's all kinds of serious things happening. And one of the fruits of the Spirit is joy. So God has plenty of joy. He has a lot of humor, too. So I hope I won't bother you too much. But I think it's always nice if I put a smile on your face before we get into something serious. And somebody sent me that for quite a while ago. And here's what it says. Ever wonder where we're headed? Sounds familiar, right? Why the sun lightens our hair but darkens our skin? Why women can't put on mascara with their mouth closed? Not too many of you probably put mascara anyway, but for those who do. Why you don't ever see the headline, Psychic Wins Lottery? Why abbreviated is such a long word? Why doctors call what they do? Practice? It's scary, isn't it? Why you have to click to on start to stop Windows? Why lemon juice is made with artificial flavor while this washing liquid is made with real lemons? Why the man who invests all your money is called a broker? Why there isn't mouse-flavored cat food? Took you a while for that one. Are you awake or what? Who tastes dog food when it has a new and improved flavor? Who tastes it? Very good point. Why Noah didn't sweat those two mosquitoes? Yeah, I wonder about that one. I'm going to have to talk to him. But it was God's creatures anyway, so I mean, you know, anyway. Why they sterilize the needle for lethal injections? Why they don't make the whole plane out of the material used for the indestructible black box? Why sheep don't shrink when it rains? Why they are called apartments when they all stuck together? If con is the opposite of pro, is Congress the opposite of progress? I think we can say that this week with what happens. Why they call the airport the terminal is flying is too safe? If flying is too safe, you know, so safe, I mean. And in case you need further proof that the human race is doomed, here are some actual labels instructions on consumer goods. on a Meyer hair dryer, do not use while sleeping. That's the only time I work on my hair. On a bag of chips, you could be a winner. No purchase necessary. Details inside. The shoplifter special. On a bar of palm leaf soap, directions, use like regular soap. And that would be what? Oh, how? On some frozen dinners, serving suggestion, defrost. But it's just a suggestion, yeah? On Nana's tiramisu dessert, printed on bottom, do not turn upside down. Well, duh, it's a little bit too late. On Marks and Spencer bread pudding, product will not will be hot after heating. On packaging for a Kmart iron, do not iron clothes on body. But wouldn't this save me more time? On Boots children cough medicine, do not drive a car or operate machinery after taking this medication. We could do a lot to reduce the rate of construction accidents if we could just get those five-year-old head colds of those forklifts. Anyway, on Nitol sleep aid, warning, may cause drowsiness. Well, I'm taking this because, you know. On most brands at Christmas lights, we don't use Christmas lights, but I mean, you know, they're all over the place. On most brands, for indoor or outdoor use only. As opposed to what? On a Japanese food processor, not to be used for the other use. Now, somebody out there help me on this. I'm a bit curious. On Nubby's peanuts, warning, contains nuts. We're really glad it does. On an American airline packet of nuts, instructions, open packet, eat nuts. Maybe fly Delta, too. Well, anyway, I think that's probably good enough for today. Since I got your attention, now we're going to get on something a little more serious. Well, there was a man who, according to God, was blameless, upright, feared God, and shunned evil. In Ezekiel 14, verse 14, God makes a significant statement. We already read that before. I'm going to read it again today. Ezekiel 14, verse 14. You know, we're going to have lots of good laughs with God. God is a happy God. He's not an austere God who's serious all the time and just want to punish everybody. He's a great being. And you just have to laugh a little more often. Ezekiel 14, 14, Son of Man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off man and beast from it. And then verse 14. Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God. My message of today is the third of the last in a mini-series of three sermons entitled Preachers of Righteousness. A few months ago, I gave you the first one, and I told you it was a series, and then I got tricked. I said, you said, if it's a series, we want the other ones. So then I was forced to come back. That's why I'm here today. I'm glad I could do that. But we reflected on the lives of Noah and Daniel, and today I propose to you that we reflect on the life of Job and try to understand why Job was special in the eyes of God. Now, here's a man who was unique. One of a kind. There was nobody like him on the earth. We have to remember that. Let us read his story. Let us try to be inspired by where this great man who, many centuries after he lived and died, still speaks to us in a very powerful way today. And he inspires us to be in the bosom of our Heavenly Father. Let's go to Job chapter 1 and verse 1. We're going to spend a lot of time today in the book of Job. Job chapter 1 and verse 1, I think it's a book that has been a lot misunderstood over the years. We've had preconceived ideas. There's a lot of lessons to learn from the book of Job. What we're going to do today, it's, you know, go over it. Because obviously, in 1 hour, I couldn't explain the book of Job. There's so much in there. But I believe that what I have to say to you today will be helpful to you, so then when you study the book, it will mean a lot more to you. Job chapter 1, verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless or perfect. Hebrew tam, T-A-M, means perfect or undefiled. And upright, Hebrew yashar, Y-A-S-H-A-R, yashar, which means upright. And one who feared God and shunned evil. What we just read sets things straight for the rest of the book. You know, we read something here that kind of presents the man and tells us, in the eyes of God, what was the man? The man is perfect as any human being can be perfect. God is happy with him. He loves him. He's satisfied with him. A lot of times we just zoom through that and we don't even think about it. But this is what God says here. Everything we're going to read from this point on has to be according to that context that we just read. The very beginning of the book where God presents everything. According to that statement. And when the trials come in, we absolutely have to remember what God said. We have to remember that. There is nothing wrong with a man. Quite the opposite. And once again, you know, we have preconceived ideas about the book of Job. I'm more interested in what God has to say. What the book is saying. See, a lot of times we assume things. And a lot of people, commentaries assume things, you know, about Job. Today I don't want to assume things. I want to go right there and see what it says. Verse 2, and 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and they were born to him. 10 children, family man, in today's standards, a large family man. In the standard of the time, roughly at the time of Abraham, it was a normal family, probably an average family. We believe he lived about the time of Abraham. We'll go back a little bit to that later. Also, verse 3, his possessions was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke or pairs of oxen, 1,000 cattle, 500 female donkeys. Wonder if there were any males in that. The males are not mentioned, but there's at least 500, females. And a very large household, lots of servants, managers, and helpers. So this man was the greatest of all the people to the east. We have to read that and read what it says. Here's a considerable man, a very important person, no ordinary man, a man of substance, prosperous, rich, influential, very prominent, possibly a king. And I'm going to quote a few passages today, and I will just mention them to you because of the sake of time. But here in Job 19, verse 9, you can jot that down. Job 19, verse 9, Job declares, "He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head." It's interesting. We zoom through that a lot of times, and we don't think what it says. "He's taken the crown from my head." Okay. Not everybody's got a crown. I don't have one. You don't have one. So he's a very important individual, possibly a king. Let's read Job chapter 3, verse 11. So we can read that one, Job chapter 3 and verse 11. And he says this, "Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth." It's interesting what he says here again. "I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who build ruins or mausoleums in some other versions for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver." Is that an indication of his status? Quite possible. To me, that would be very logical. If he had been an ordinary man, he would not have spoken of being put to rest in the company of kings and counselors and princes. See, we don't think about those things. We zoom through the whole book and we assume, okay, the book is about a self-righteous man. Well, we're going to come back to that. Is it what the book is all about? Is it about the only lesson? You may be surprised. It's what a lot of people say, but I really don't see much of that in there. But anyway, I'm going ahead of myself here. Job chapter 4, verse 3. Surely you have instructed many, says one of his companions, Eliphaz the Temanite, referring to him as a counselor, someone people look up to. And you have strengthened weak hands, referring seemingly to benevolent activities of his. Verse 4 of Job chapter 4, your words have upheld him who was stumbling. Once again, they could only describe someone of substance, highly respected, and a doer of good works. And you have strengthened the feeble knees. Job was a good man. Job was a good man. Job chapter 29, verse 7, we're just going, just trying to describe the man once again. So then we have to go to different spots in the book. Job 29, verse 7 says this. When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat, or in the open square. Wow, he took a seat in the open square. So once again, not just about any ordinary man in here. The young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood. Not just any ordinary man. The princes refrain from talking. Everybody hushes when he's there. Wow. And put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me. Because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no helper. The blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. Think about all those things that he was doing. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. Verse 21, men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my countenance they did not cast down. I chose the way for them, and I sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king once again in the army, as one who comforts mourners. I think that would be sufficient, you know, to kind of describe the man, and then we realize with these words that it was quite a man. Now back to Job chapter 1 and verse 4. Let's go back to the beginning of the book now. Job chapter 1 and verse 4. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. They just had parties. They had a good time. So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Look at the attitude of the man. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Talking here of a time when the Levitical priesthood was not introduced yet, when people sacrificed for themselves, like in Abraham's time. And Job did that because, once again, he was blameless and upright, feared God and shunned evil. What comes next is very important. It sets the real context of the entire book for us. It tells us Job suffered a lot, physically, mentally and spiritually. And he tells us why. And the main reason does not seem to be self-righteousness. I don't think it is at all. Verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. It's a very evasive answer, you know. He didn't really give much details in there. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? That's what we need to look at. There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. See, this is, we have to remember the whole thing when we read the rest of the book. This statement is very significant. It tells us what God thinks of Job. He tells Satan, there is none like him on the earth, one of a kind, a blameless and an upright man who fears God, unlike Satan, and shuns evil, unlike Satan as well. That's quite a description. One we wish that God could give of us, right? Verse 9, so Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? So here we go. He goes on the attack. Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Now right there we notice there's something Satan does not understand or does not know about Job. Satan does not understand something here. He thinks his righteousness is solely based on his physical blessings. It is quite interesting. You know, it reveals that Satan does not always know us or understand how we feel. He does not always understand. He pretends he does, but he doesn't always do it. Actually, I think a lot of times he does not understand. He could not understand that Job over there. He was jealous of him. He didn't like him. And it's why he went on the attack. Verse 12, and the Lord said to him, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord to do his dirty work. See, God allowed him. Now we have to understand that. Why did God allow it? And then in order to understand that, we have to look at the end of the book and see what happened in the long run. But we're not there yet. Verse 13. Now there was a day when the sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their older brother's house. And the messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. Then the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. There's something terrible happening. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, yet another also came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Talk about your world falling apart. Suddenly, in a matter of hours and a very short period of time, no one has ever experienced anything like this to such an extent, so rapidly, in a matter of hours. Job finds himself completely naked. He's got nothing left. He's lost everything. How would we have reacted? It's a good question, isn't it? If something happened like that, if we have a big trial happening to us today, how would we react? How do we react? A direct attack from Satan. a very heinous, destructive, cruel, unjustified attack. Job did nothing to deserve that. We have to remember that. He had not done anything wrong. Yet what was his reaction? An incredible one. Incredible reaction. Verse 20, then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. How many of us would have done that? And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Wow! What a reaction! That's a converted man right here. That's a righteous man right here. He's got his eyes on God. He says, hey, you know, bless God. Blessed be the great God in heaven. And look at verse 22. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. We have to remember, when we read those verses, they're key verses. They explain the whole book. That was Job's reaction to Satan's first strike. Okay, to understand the whole book, we have to understand that God is love and he did not attack Job. God did not attack Job. Satan did. God allowed it, but it's Satan who attacked him. He only allowed Satan to hurt him and probably to prove a point to Satan, showing him he definitely does not see eye to eye with him. It does not always even understand humans. Satan doesn't always understand humans. A lot of times, see, we're going to replace him one day. Satan doesn't know what's in our heart a lot of times. And to make Job even stronger, that's one of the reasons why God allowed it, to make Job even stronger. When we have trials in life, sometimes it's the purpose that God has in mind. He says, I know you can go through that, and you're going to be stronger spiritually, so I allow it. It's not fair, it's cruel, but I allow it. And then once again, if you look at the end of the book, Job was stronger than ever. So at the end, Satan probably thought, I should have bit my tongue and kept my mouth shut. But it was too late, wasn't it? Because by the end of the book, you have a man who is even stronger than ever before. But that's the end of the book, isn't it? Now let's notice what God says, Job chapter 2, verse 2. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come from? So second time, where do you come from? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going on to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Same very evasive answer, you know, doesn't give any details. And you wonder if there's not a bit of a mockery in there in his answer. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth. And once again, he repeats the same thing. There is none like him on the earth. A blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. And still, he holds fast to his integrity. And there's nothing wrong with that statement here. God is not saying it's wrong. He holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Key words, without cause, once again. Now, God repeats that he has nothing against Job. He has nothing against a man. Once again, Satan, thinking wrongly that Job could not be as righteous as that, asked for another strike. This time against his very body and health. He's taken everything he has. Now he wants to attack his body, his health. If he could have done it, he would have destroyed the man, but God did not allow it. Verse 4, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. See, that's his reasoning. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. That's what Satan believes. That's what Satan believes. Job chapter 2, verse 7. Job chapter 2, verse 7. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd and with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Can you imagine the suffering of that man? I mean, his world has completely fallen apart. He's got nothing left. And he's hurting terribly. He's suffering terribly. How long were his sufferings? That's a good question. We thought, well, maybe he suffered just for a few hours and then, you know. Oh, no. Oh, no. Let's go to Job chapter 7, verse 3. Job chapter 7 and verse 3. And I go rather quickly through some of these, you know, so you may just want to jot them down if, you know. So I have been allotted months of futility, says here. Months of futility, at least a number of days in terrible pain. His companions, as mentioned in verse 13, stayed with him silent for 7 days and seven nights even before they said anything. You have to remember that. So at least 7 days and seven nights he's suffering terribly and nobody has said anything yet, but that's already a long time. If you and I were suffering the kind of suffering he had, that would be an eternity. A whole week like this, I mean, in pain, and you can barely sleep, and, you know, terrible. So, and worrisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise, and the night be ended? For I have had my fill of tossing till dawn. My flesh is quaked with worms and dust. Can you imagine the kind of disease he had? Terrible one. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. You have Job chapter 19, verse 20 as well that talks about that. How long did he suffer? Job 19, verse 20, my bone clings to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Now, how does Job respond to Satan's second strike? How did he respond? What is his reaction? Verse 9 to 10 now. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Wow, really helpful woman, isn't she? Wow, what a great wife. Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. See, God keeps insisting, and several times throughout the book, he keeps saying the same thing. Job did not sin. He was fine. At this point, Job is abandoned of all his friends, all alone, despised. And when you've been a man of substance, it's probably a lot harder than blokes like us, you know, didn't really have much importance in the neighborhood, you know. But then when you've been really important, and then suddenly everybody shuns you and doesn't see you anymore, doesn't recognize you, just, you know, it must be a lot harder. It must be. Job chapter 19, verse 13. Job 19, verse 13, he has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my close friends have forgotten me. Those who dwell in my house and my maid servants count me as a stranger. I'm an alien in their sight. I call my servant, but he gives no answer. Who cares? Am I the way you are now? You're not my boss anymore. My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am repulsive to the children of my body. Even young children despise me. I arise and they speak against me. All my close friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. Can you imagine the loneliness that suddenly this man has? I don't think we envision that. I don't think we understand it completely. Job chapter 30, verse 1. Job chapter 30, verse 1. And that's on the subject here of how lonely he is suddenly. You know, his world has fallen apart. And Job 30, verse 1, but now they mock at me. Men younger than I, whose fathers had disdained to put with the dogs in my flock. In other words, I mean, they were people not really of good reputation, you know. And those guys now are against me. They were sons of fools, yes, sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. And now I am their taunting song. Yes, I am there by word. They bore me. They keep far from me. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. Because he has loosed my bowstring and afflicted me, they have cast off restraints before me. At my right hand, the rabble arise. They push away my feet, and they raise against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They have no helper. Can you imagine the loneliness of the man? And you know, at this stage, Job realizes that His sufferings may have afflicted his way of thinking a little bit. He admits that as well. Why do I say that? Because once again, you know, if he says things in the book that maybe think a little bit irrational, think about his situation. Please do. The man is suffering terribly. Job chapter 6, verse 1, then Job answered and said, "Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it on the scales, for then I would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been harsh." He realized his words may have been harsh, but he has a good reason to react this way, doesn't he? "For the arrows of the Almighty are within me. My spirit drinks in their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." Now, the rest of the book has to be understood in light of Job's reaction to this terrible trial. We have to understand, first of all, that Job is suffering terribly. Job is suffering terribly. So if he says things sometimes, hey, you know, how many human beings would have reacted the way he did in the first place? So Job was suffering terribly. Second, he could not figure out what was wrong. He could not understand what was wrong. So he kept doing the right thing, but it's, you know, and people say, well, you know, you justify yourself. No, he kept doing what he was doing all along. He could not understand at this stage what was going on. I guess one day we'll realize at one point God revealed to him the battle that was going on in heaven. But he didn't do that from the start, did he? Job didn't know from the start what was going on. He didn't know Satan was attacking him. He had no clue. So not only he was suffering terribly, but he could not figure out what was wrong. We have to remember that. We have to understand that. Now, he said things may be irrational at times, but he had an excuse. How many of us would have reacted the way he did? How many of us would have reacted the way he did? I doubt too many of us. See, Job was a preacher of righteousness, as we read in Ezekiel 14:14 to start with. God looked at that man as a preacher of righteousness. Fourth reason, the reason for his suffering was Satan's hatred. Not because he did anything stupid. It was because of Satan. That was the reason of his suffering. Satan's jealousy, his desire to destroy him. Satan is God's adversary and he's ours also. He hates us. He hates the idea that we will be higher than him one day. He hates that. And sometimes he attacks human beings. Sometimes he may attack some of you. There's nothing wrong with what you're doing. It just says Satan hates your guts. He's trying to get you. And in those times, we have to be strong. And I guarantee you, until Christ comes back, he's going to strike again. And maybe more closely, more personally to some of us. That doesn't mean we're doing anything wrong. That means he hates us. He wants to destroy us. And God will not allow him further than he allows it. So God is the one who puts the limits in all of that. Now, fifth remark that I have here is Job was a bit self-righteous is because he could not figure out what was wrong with the picture. I mean, he was allowed a little bit of self-righteousness, wasn't he? I mean, the minimum self-righteousness. But to say that the whole book is about a self-righteous man, I think it's missing the point. Job must have been quite an educated and intelligent man, but he still didn't know everything. But his heart was right before God. We must be careful not to misjudge him. Some of God's people are attacked by Satan, like I said, so we got to remember that too. Sometimes we look at people and they go through diseases or through heavy trials and we think, oh, he must have done something wrong somewhere. You know, God is really showing him something here. No, not necessarily, brethren. Not necessarily. Like I said, a lot of times maybe Satan is just after that person because that person was righteous. Or there's something right they're doing and Satan hates it. It's quite possible. We cannot assume things. It's dangerous to assume. We have to see what's in the book and not what's not there. We have to make sure we see what God is trying to tell us. Righteousness has to do with self-sacrifice. It is the spirit of agape love. We have to be willing to suffer to become righteous. Are we willing to become righteous? Are we willing to suffer? See, Job was willing to suffer. He went all the way. Did he understand what was going on? No. But he went all the way. A good part of the book, 15 chapters, has to do with Job's friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, whatever, all these ites over there. And Eliu, you know. So you got four friends in there. And a lot of chapters, and I want you to read them, to study them, because they're fascinating. And I don't have the time today to go through all what they say. But it is fascinating when you study one person at a time, see what they have to say. It's fascinating. Then you start understanding the book a lot better. What is revealing with each one of these men is that they assume a lot of things. They assume a lot. It's one of the things that they all did there. Those four men, they assume things. You see, they did not know what was going on either. So they say the man suffering, they say, oh, he must have sinned before God. Wrong. Now, Eliu, who is the youngest, got it basically right, but if you read Eliu's answer as well, you will find, I guarantee you, you will find something in there. This is not completely right either. So even long Eliu at the end, who just said, hey, you three men, you're older than me. I kept my mouth shut. I respected you, but frankly, you're full of beans, you know. But you know, after that, himself, he's not completely straight either. But God said, well, good enough. But those three, if you read the rest of the book, God really has something against them. Now let's take some samples of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So far, so good. And then Job chapter 4, verse 1. Job chapter 4, verse 1. Then Eliphaz answered and said, if one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Surely you have instructed many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees. And he's making a statement about how great the man was there. And then verse 5 said, but now it comes upon you and you are weary. It touches you in your trouble. Try to do it yourself, buddy. You know, it's easy to criticize here, but try. What if you were in this situation? You know. Is not your reverence your confidence and the integrity of your ways your hope? There's nothing wrong with that. See, Job still doesn't know what's going on there. Verse 12 to 21 are particularly revealing. Now, we believe that Eliphaz is describing here a consultation with one of several demons. What we read is typical of a seance, you know, one of those occult seances. So, verse 12 to 21, now a word was secretly brought to me, and my ear received a whisper of it. In disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones shake. Is this, you know, when an angel talks to you, that's not the way you feel. When demons talk to you, that's what happens. Then a spirit passed. Spirit passed before my face. The hair on my body stood up. You know, your hair and on your arms. And it's not an angel here. This is not an angel speaking here. It's not an experience with an angel, a servant of God. So then the spirit passed before my face. The hair on my body stood up. I stood still. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. See, the demons, when they appear, they it's not like an angel where there's a particular figure that you can see there. The demons really are like specters or something that's, you know, not really completely definite. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. Then I heard a voice saying, can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his maker? And try to imagine here the voice. We believe it's a demon speaking. We believe it's a demon speaking. And that demon says, verse 18, if he puts no trust in his servants, and in me probably, you know, the third demon speaking, if he charges his angels with error, some translations have folly. There's a bit of mocking in those words, like enemies of God, or God's people who accuse God and his people of the very things they do. They do that all the time. So here you have a spirit being that's, you know, that's mocking the situation. How much more are those who dwell in houses of clay? See, if God finds folly among us, how much more folly is he going to find, you know, with human beings? For a number of years, we looked at that passage and we just went through it, and then we realized there's an excellent sermon by Mr. Pinelli that he gave about that particular chapter here a number of months ago. I hope you can listen to it sometimes. But we've been looking at that book for a while, number of ministers, and then we realize, hey, wait a minute, there's something wrong in here. This is not a normal situation. It looks like it's pretty much describing a demon or demons talking to that man. So Eliphaz didn't go to God. He consulted the demons to have the answer to the problem in there, apparently. Job chapter 5, at least it's the understanding we have now, you know. Job chapter 5, verse 6 to 8, for affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble spring from the ground. See, once again, he starts assuming things. Say, oh, you're in trouble, so it's because you have sinned. Yet man is born in trouble, and the sparks fly upward. But as for me, I would seek God, oh hypocrite. I would seek God. You're seeking a demon right there. You're not seeking God. But, you know, this is the self-righteous attitude. So when we're talking about self-righteous, who is self-righteous in the book? I would venture to say to you very strongly that those four guys were more self-righteous than the man Job. As for me, I would seek God. And to God I would commit my cause. Seems a bit hypocritical. Would Eliphaz do that? Is he righteous? Seems he's more interested in the occult. And once again, I cannot go through the details in here, but if you do that, if you study the book, study the different characters, and see what they say and see what they do. Because we're going to see something interesting with Eliphaz here. Verse 17, behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. Assuming once again that Job has sinned. He assumes that Job has sinned. Verse 27, behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear it and know for yourself. Well, here I see self-righteous too. And you say, hey, we have the answer. You don't. Job chapter 15, verse 1, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, so once again, we spend a little time with Eliphaz, you know, and in chapter 15, he said, answered and said, should a wise man answer with empty knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Should the reason with unprofitable talk or by speeches which can do no good? He keeps going. He keeps going. Well, Job, you're full of baloney. You know, Job, what you say doesn't make sense. You know, we have the answer, but you don't. Yes, you cast off fear and restrain prayer before God, for your iniquity teaches your mouth. Ah, things are starting to change. Okay. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. He's saying exactly the opposite of what he was saying before. Did you notice that? So Eliphaz is actually contradicting himself royally. Now he's on the attack. Now he's saying the contrary. He thought Job was a great man. We have seen what he said, how he described him in the beginning of the book. And then suddenly he just turns his coat, we may say. He just says the opposite. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you. Verse 15, if God puts no trust in his saints or angels, and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water? That's how he described Job. And there's the first part is interesting here. This is, you know, probably demons speaking there too. God puts no trust in his saints or his angels, according to some translations. See, the demons really they criticize God. So, well, you don't trust us. You bet we don't trust you. God doesn't trust some of the angels. He doesn't trust the demons. Job chapter 22, verse 5. Job 22, verse 5. So we see there's ambiguity with that man. Eliphaz just says one thing in the beginning, and then he contradicts himself and starts saying the opposite. Job chapter 22, verse 5. Is not your wickedness great? And once again, he's talking to Job. Is not your wickedness great? He's on the attack once again. And your iniquity without end? That's his opinion of Job now. Eliphaz contradicts himself. For you have taken pledges from your brother and for no reason and stripped the naked of their clothing. He said exactly the opposite before. You have not given the weary water to drink and you have withheld bread from the hungry. But the mighty man possessed the land and the honorable man dwells in it. You have sent widows away empty and the strength of the fatherless was crushed. Therefore snares are all around you and sudden fear troubles you. It just boggles the mind. The man has just turned his coat. Suddenly he's just saying the opposite. Did you notice that? So you notice that if you study the characters one at a time, and that you'll have to do it yourself. I'm giving you a sample today. Once again, this is such a big book, you know. And it takes a while to figure things out. So totally false accusations, the opposite of what was said in chapter 4. The opposite, the very opposite. So Eliphaz turns around and just starts accusing Job of the opposite of what he praised him for before, to start with. And he has the hypocrisy to say, verse 21, now acquaint yourself with him and be at peace. Thereby goodwill will come to you. If you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. You will remove iniquity far from your tents. I've seen enough. I've seen enough about that guy. Now, how about Bildad now? How about Bildad? Okay, Job chapter 8, verse 1. Job chapter 8, verse 1. See, you have to read everything within its context. You remember, context is very important. Who said what? At what moment? Is what they are saying true or not? So you have to ask yourself those questions when you read the book of Job. You have to ask yourself a lot of questions. Job chapter 8, verse 1 now. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you speak these things? And the words of your mouth will be like a strong wind. Does God subvert judgment, or does the Almighty prefer justice? If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression. You know, here we go. They assume things. Oh, your sons must have sinned. So, I mean, you know, they deserved it. God cast them away because they did something wrong. They had no proofs of that. Absolutely no proofs. If you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place. Though your beginning was small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly. And he's doing a prophecy here because it's exactly what's going to happen. But he didn't see it that way when he said that. Job 25, verse 4. Job 25, verse 4. Bildad says that as well. How then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? And once again, you really wonder who's speaking in there. That book of Job is really interesting. There's probably more demons speaking at different times in that book than we think. Because when you see what's being said, it's interesting. It's, you know, it's kind of typical of what the wrong kind of spirits are going to say. How about so far? So far, so good, like I said. Well, but let's go to so far anyway. Or Zophar, I don't know how you want to pronounce it. Job chapter 11, verse 2. Job chapter 11, verse 2. So far. And we take just a sample of what those guys are saying. Job chapter 11, verse 2. Should not the multitude of words be answered? Once again, Job, you talk, you know, you justify yourself. You know, we've had enough of all of that. You know, you're just babbling and, you know. But Job is terribly suffering. He doesn't know what's going on. And he explains and said, I want to do this. I did good. I was fine. And, yeah. You know, they don't believe him. But they assume a lot of things. Once again, they assume he's done something wrong. So should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be vindicated? Should your empty talk make men hold their peace? And when you mock, should no one rebuke you? For you have said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in your eyes. And you know, through all those chapters, God never says that, you know, he found anything wrong with Job. It's what those people are saying. It's what they say. It's their opinions. It's important to realize that. So if Job said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in your eyes, God, well, he's done that for years. He's righteous. He keeps doing the same thing. Verse 7, can you search out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? The limits of the Almighty? Okay, that's fine. I understand that. Verse 14, if iniquity were in your hand, and you put it far away, and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents. Come on. Wickedness dwell in your tent. See, himself as well, he just assumes that there's wickedness in Job's life. That's not what God said. So is this man right when he says that? No, he's not. It's his opinion, once again. Job 20, verse 1. Then Zophar answered and said, therefore my anxious thoughts make me answer because of the turmoil within me. You're boiling inside, eh? You just want to say something. I have heard the rebuke that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. The spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. Well, what a humble guy. See, you really have to see what's being said there. I think a lot of times we just zoom through those verses and we don't realize what's in there. Then he gives a number of generalities as well. And this book is full of generalities, by the way. Sometimes you'll find some statements that are perfectly fine. The statements are fine, but the attitude of those who say it is wrong. So you'll find things in what those men say that say, yeah, that's true. Yeah, but the attitude is wrong. They should not be saying those things because they're hypocrites. Or they have hypocrisy. I don't know if they're hypocrites on a regular basis, but, you know. Job chapter 32, verse 1. Job's 32 and verse 1. We read this, and once again, let's see what's in there. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. It's not God saying that either. He was righteous in his own eyes. And if he was righteous, didn't he have the right to think that way? So think about it. Job had practiced God's way all these years. He kept doing the right thing, and he knew it was right. As we should know when we do the right thing, I am doing the right thing. I may be persecuted for it, but I know it's the right thing to do, and I will keep doing it. There's nothing wrong about that, is there? So they stopped answering him because they figured, well, she's not listening anyway, but, you know. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. And once again, yes, maybe he did, but, you know, take it for that's your opinion there. Also, against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. That in itself is interesting. So Elihu is looking at those three and he said, you know, you've not been able to answer his questions. You've not been able to counter what he was saying. So what you three guys have been saying have been useless because you missed the point. But I, Elihu, of course, I don't miss the point. I'm the only one who understands the whole thing, right? It's amazing. It really is amazing. Now, because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. And that's fine. You know, he did the right thing there. I paid close attention to you, verse 12. And surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words. Job 33, verse 1. Job 33 and verse 1, but please, Job, hear my speech and listen to all my words. My words come from my upright heart. My lips utter pure knowledge. I don't see much humility in here, personally, when I read those words. I don't see much humility. Surely, verse 8, you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your words, saying, I am pure without transgression, I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me. Yet he finds occasions against me. He counts me as his enemy. And that's true. Job could not understand, what is God doing here? Why does he allow that? See, I mean, he was not irrational. He was trying to figure out what's going on. Verse 12, look, in this you are not righteous. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Now that's fine. Once again, there's nothing wrong with that statement. Job 34, verse 5. Job 34, verse 5 now. For Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. But when Job was saying that, once again, he was trying to figure things out. He was trying to understand. And in all those chapters or verses, you don't have one place where God says, Job sinned in that. It's quite the opposite. Actually, we're going to read it toward the end of the book. So we have to remember that those four men have no clue what's going on. See, themselves, they have no clue what's going on. They don't know there's a battle in heaven somewhere. And Satan wants to get Job's skin. He wants to get the man. He wants to destroy him. They don't know that. Job doesn't know that either. They do not know that Satan is after Job, who is righteous, who is totally puzzled, and that God always allows that to refine the man, to refine him further. Verse 10 of Job 34, therefore listen to me, you men of understanding, far be it from God to do wickedness, and far from the Almighty to commit iniquity. That's the way he looks at things. For he repays man according to his work. Here we go again. He repays man according to his work. So in his opinion here, he must have done something wrong. And makes man to find a reward according to his way. Surely God will never do wickedly. Well, that's true. Nor will the Almighty pervert justice. That's true. See, you got some statements that are right, but it's mixed with misunderstanding or error. So who said what is important for us? And Elihu, who seems to be the most reasonable of the four, makes a stupid statement. Verse 35. Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom. As far as I'm concerned, it's a stupid statement. He should have kept his mouth shut at that particular time. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of the wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Brethren, do you really believe that describes Job? No. It doesn't, does it? And again, Job 35, verse 1, Job 35 and verse 1, moreover, Elihu answered and said, do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? You're missing the point, Elihu. For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than I have sinned, more than if I have sinned? And verse 16, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. Once again, that's your opinion, buddy. That's your opinion, Elihu. That's what you think, but frankly, this is not what God says. There's a difference between the two, a huge difference. And then apparently a storm is building up, a storm is gathering, and Elihu suddenly feels pretty small. The reason I say this is because we read shortly after, then the Lord answered God out of the whirlwind. So there must have been something going on. There's something brewing in there. He answered Job, out of the whirlwind, there must have been a tempest or a storm, a big storm that's gathering. And it's, you know, God had that in mind. That was about time that God decided to say something. But he's allowed those people to say those things, you know, for a number of chapters. Now it's God's time to say something. And so we read in Job chapter 37, verse 1, at this also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He would not have said that unless there was no storm building up. You know, first, like he said, that, you know, there is a whirlwind. God is answering from the whirlwind there. And at the same time, he kind of confirms that. He sends it forth under the whole heaven, his lightning to the ends of the earth. So he's talking about what he's seeing right now, apparently. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which we cannot comprehend. I kind of imagine a little bit. Suddenly, you know, Elihu starts feeling a little funny. Ooh, there's something going on. Maybe I should be careful with what I say by now. Maybe I went a little too far, you know. Verse 14, listen to this, O Job. Job, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. And now he's switching. Consider the wondrous works of God. What are we supposed to make of all of this? Undoubtedly, there are many lessons, but one has to be careful not to draw the wrong conclusions, as Job's companions did, and as many people still do, and as many commentaries still do. They assume that the book of Job is only about self-righteousness, and they miss the point. They miss the point. Because if you study every character, you realize that those characters are more self-righteous than Job was. But study their statements. Study what they say. And I cannot do that for yourself. You have to do it yourself. I hope you will study the book of Job, you know, in the next few weeks or whatever, and start doing that. Just see who says what. When? See when God says something. See when those people say something, when it's their opinions. And make in your mind, just decide in your mind, was it right to say such a thing? It's important. So it's like everywhere, every time we look in the Bible and read a particular verse, we have to ask ourselves those basic questions. Who is speaking there? To whom? When? How? You know, all these questions. We have to dig in there and see what's going on. So here are some of the lessons we can learn from that inspiring book. Some lessons we can learn from that inspiring book. Job was righteous. God says that several times in the book and all the way to the end. I think this is the first lesson we have to learn. Job was righteous. God said so several times in the book, all the way to the end. And we're going to go to Job 42, because God is saying something very significant here at the end of the book. Certainly not accusing Job of anything. Job 42 and verse 7. And so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends. God is not very happy with those people. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Wow. As my servant Job has. You have not said the right thing. Job has. Okay, so he has all throughout all these chapters. Now therefore, verse 8, take for yourself 7 bulls and 7 rams, go to my servant Job and offer up for yourself a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For I will accept him, not you, I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, and zap you off right there. Because I've heard enough. So God is merciful. He said, talk to Job. I'm not in the mood to, you know, to say nice things to you at this point. Well, I don't know if God would say that, but anyway, you know, just, you get the point, you get the drift. And because you have not spoken of me once again, see, he repeats that in verse 8, because you have not spoken of me, what is right? Interesting. What is right? As my servant Job did. So when we read the book, we have to remember what's in the beginning, what sets the whole context, because if we forget that context, then we misunderstand the whole book. Then we have to go all the way to the end and realize what God is saying at the end of this book. He says there's nothing wrong with Job. On the contrary. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, or whatever, went and did as the Lord commanded them, for the Lord had accepted Job. Not them, but he did. Second lesson, important lesson from the book, the main cause for Job's suffering was Satan. See, we have to remember that when we read the book of Job. The main reason for Job's suffering is Satan. It's not his unrighteousness or whatever, anything wrong he did. It's Satan who's jealous of him. We cannot really understand how a human being can be more righteous than him, Lucifer. That's why the demons in there are different. Spot they say, well, God finds folly in his angels. Not all his angels, the third of his angels that went the wrong way, that went with Lucifer. But they're mocking spirits. They say, oh, he finds folly with us. And rightly so. Rightly so. But the main cause of Job's suffering was Satan. He was jealous of Job and he wanted to destroy him. He wanted to destroy him. And who knows if he doesn't try to destroy some of us. Like I said, let's not be too surprised sometimes. Let's not assume things. When somebody suffers, has a very serious disease or whatever, you know, sometimes maybe that's Satan who's after us. He wants us. Third lesson we can learn from the book, Job did not understand what was happening to him. And that's important to understand that too. Job did not understand what was happening to him. He had no idea Satan was trying to destroy him personally. How would we have reacted in such a situation? Lesson number four, the trials we go through in life are not necessarily the result of sins. They are not necessarily the results of sins. Sometimes it is plainly an attack from Satan. There's several other places in the Bible that shows that God hates the church. He's going to try to persecute it, you know, all the way to the end. And frankly, we've seen that over the years, haven't we? See, now he has tried to destroy the church, to split us all over the place, to divide us. And he did pretty good in some cases. But God sifted as well. So I look at it in a positive way. I think God has been doing some sifting. So when we're tried, there's two ways to go. Abandon or keep going with God and say, I'm going to stick to the truth. But some have abandoned the course. So the trials we go through life are not necessarily the result of sin. Sometimes it's plainly Satan's attack. Then number five, when people suffer or get very ill, be careful not to assume that you know the reason. That goes with the one before, but it's, you know, kind of makes it a little more plain. So when people suffer or get very ill, be careful not to assume you know the reason. Job's companions made that very serious mistake. They assumed he had sinned when he had not. Six, Job's companion did not know what was going on. They formed their own opinions. Job's companions did not know what was going on and they formed their own opinions. And I think it kind of forces us to realize, hey, I got to be careful when I make judgments too. See, they assumed. Don't we do that? All of us at times in life, we assume things. We think we know the answer, we think we know the reason, but do we? And the last big lesson that we have to learn from the book of Job is that God is refining us. God is refining us. Suffering has a way to refine us and to make us stronger and to prepare us for higher office in the kingdom. In some cases, when God brings us a trial, we say, "Oh God, please leave it there. Leave it there. I've had enough. Please, please. I don't think I can go any further. Please, God, please, please, please." And God on His throne says, "I know you. I know you're strong. I think you can take a little more. And if you can take a little more, you'll be even stronger in my kingdom. You'll have a higher post in my kingdom. You'll have a higher position in my kingdom." So I'm more interested in that. See, God's reasoning is not always the human reasoning. So God is refining us. Suffering has a way to refine us and make us stronger and to prepare us for a higher office in His kingdom. See, when you see the end of the book, when you see how much Noah was blessed too, but I mean, I'm talking about Job today. How much he was blessed. He had more after this whole trial. He was more blessed. He had more after the trial. So God was obviously, you know, very happy with him, and he passed the test. He did. So, and at this stage, Satan, like I said, probably realized at one point, I should have kept my mouth shut. We have to make sure that we do the same thing so Satan can say the same thing about us. Sometimes I wish I had kept my mouth shut and not accuse him or her before God, because now he or she's stronger. Like Noah and Daniel, Job did not compromise with God's way. He was willing to suffer to remain in God's bosom, and he did. For him, there was only one way to go. It should be the same for us. Noah was a preacher of righteousness. He's still preaching to us today, even though he's been through a lot of things. Noah, same thing with Daniel, and same thing with Job, like we saw today. Those three very special beings that God said about them that they were righteous men. Righteous. Let's end up this message today with Romans chapter 8, and verse 36. Romans 8 and verse 36. "As it is written, for your sake we are killed all day long, we are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor heights, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Let us, by our conduct and our thoughts, be preachers of righteousness as well as to those all around us."